all my soul sisters. Let me hear your flow, sisters.
Hey, sister, go, sister, soul, sister, flow, sister. Oh.
Freedom, beauty, truth, love, boas, fishnets, Elton John, sex, tango, and confetti cannons. All of this and so much more can be found in the extravagant, saucy, and just plain fun Broadway adaptation of Baz Luhrmann's movie Moulin Rouge. The stage version of this love story has lavish sets, sparkling costumes, and nonstop singing and dancing, including all your favorite pop hits from the film, plus a batch of new additions, Outkast, Lorde, Beyoncé, Sia, and many more, some sung in their entirety, and some mashups with a splash of Broadway. Directed by Alex Timbers. Hi, Alex.
Hey.
The show stars Karen Olivo and Aaron, let me get this right, Aaron Tveit, as the star-crossed lovers Satine and Christian, who meet one fateful night in Paris at the oh-so-extra Moulin Rouge. The pair quickly fall in love, but a wealthy and controlling duke stands between them, and a happy ending, and you know the rest. Moulin Rouge opens at the Hirschfeld Theater on July 25th, and Alex is in studio. You are not getting a lot of sleep.
No, it's been a really exciting time, yeah.
So when did the idea of bringing the film to Broadway, when did that happen? And then when did you come aboard?
Well, I think producers have been trying to do that for a while. And it was about 10 years ago that an Australian producer named Carmen Pavlovic was working with Baz Luhrmann and said to Baz, you know, I'd like to do this. And Baz said, okay. And then about 6 years ago, I was at a dinner party and met Baz. And he had seen a couple of shows I had done that were sort of like a historical contemporary mashup things. One called Here Lies Love that I'd done with David Byrne about Imelda Marcos and set in a discotheque. And another show called Blay Blay Andrew Jackson mm-hmm. that was kind of like an emo take on our seventh president. And Baz emailed me the next day and he said,
you're weird. Yay.
Yeah. He's like, I see a kindred spirit. Let's talk.
So as my next question had all of your credits in there. You directed Beetlejuice, Rocky, nominated for Tonys for Peter and the Star Catcher, and Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. I told you I love Mozart in the Jungle, which you had a hand in. And also John Mulaney's Kid Gorgeous special.
Oh, that's so fun. He's the best.
So those are very different things. What does a project need to have for you to get on board and get excited about it?
Well, I didn't grow up as a theater kid. I grew up in Manhattan, but I didn't go see musicals or plays that much growing up. And so I think for me, the moment that I sort of saw theater in a new light was when I first saw Tommy on Broadway and saw something that felt like that it was in dialogue with popular culture, that had music, video, visuals, and it was sweeping and romantic and epic and tragic, and thought, oh, it's not just sort of rarefied entertainment. There's something that feels modern and contemporary. And so the things that I love having done improv and sketch comedy are moments where comedy and theater overlap, or when you're creating big visual worlds on stage, both of which is true of Beetlejuice and Moulin Rouge. And so that stuff really excites me.
What's a challenge of directing something this big, this lavish, this extravagant? I mean, there's a windmill going,
right,
there's
yeah.
a giant elephant on the other side of the theater. I thought to myself, there's not a red light bulb in New York City that's not in this theater. It's just so big.
Yeah, well, I think when you're thinking of Moulin Rouge, you're thinking of scope, you know? And I felt like as an audience member, because I always think about the audience, you know, like, what do I want when I'm going to see Moulin Rouge? And I want to step into that club. Mm-hmm. I want to, like, from the moment I walk through those doors on 45th Street, just to be transported to this, to Belle Epoque Paris. And so that's what we've really tried to do. And so when you step into that theater, you know, there's, you feel like you're in that club. And then from that point on, as we're telling the story, we are trying to visit these different worlds of the sort of the, we have the kind of deluxe maximalism of the club, and then the kind of sort of grim, sobering poverty of the streets outside the club. And then you go into kind of the sort of beautiful, aspirational world of the Duke and the Boulevard at another point. And so you're trying to be really strict with yourself about, you know, the transporting people to those worlds, but being very specific about the rules of each world.
So that idea of having people be immersed immediately, is that what went into the idea that the players are in the audience and sort of just start arriving on the stage before the show even starts. That's sort of interesting.
That's exactly right. You know, you watch that movie and it's immersive as a film. You know, you might be sitting in a movie theater, but it leaps off the screen. But we in the theater don't have whip pans and steady cams racing through the streets, and we don't have like music video style editing. So what do we have? We have the ability to break the fourth wall, to have a, you know, a performer basically, you know, 2 feet away from you, and have, you know, hyper contemporary lighting, and just, you know, so we're trying to use everything within our vocabulary to create something that's unique, that's really for the stage, that's not a replica of the movie, but gives you the same kind of energy and excitement of what it was to see that film.
My guest is Alex Timbers. He's the director of the new Broadway show Moulin Rouge. I went the other night and I saw you go backstage and then come back out and go back. And I thought, gosh, he's in previews. What is it you're doing during previews at that time, right before a show starts?
So I've been working on the show, as I said, for 6 years, but previews are the most exciting and important part, because what's happening every night is the audience is coming and you're listening to what they're responding to or what they're not responding to. And then the next day you go in and tweak things, whether that's rewriting script, recalibrating performances, changing up songs. So it's a real living thing, and it's the most exciting but also, you know, kind of stressful part of the process.
Because you did actually open in Boston, right?
We opened in Boston a year ago, and we've changed a bunch of stuff since then. Yeah.
What's an example of something? I'm just curious.
The Bohemians used to enter to a song at the top of the show called Rhythm of the Night, and now they enter to Burning Down the House from the Talking Heads.
That's great.
That's really great. A really nice improvement. I mean, the other song's great, but this is even better.
And it's also, it's sort of unexpected because it's a different era of music. And it's also new wave music, as opposed to we're hearing all the pop and the sort of the dance music and the ballads. And then it's like, oh, wow, Talking Heads. That's kind of great. Baz Luhrmann was involved in this quite a bit. What were some of the things that you talked about that needed to be in this show?
Well, in the first conversation, the two big things we hit on immediately were changing the kind of sort of framing device of how the film works, and basically having the scenic envelope and the audience experience be set around the club. Okay. So the show begins and ends there. And then the second was that there were certain advantages when they released the film in 2001 to what songs they were using had a kind of different cultural meaning or relevance or contemporaneous. And so we were saying, well, can we take advantage of music in the last 18 years in the intervening period and make sure that the audience has that same sort of idea of a relationship to the catalog? So we have music that's much more contemporary, but then we have like Hoagie Carmichael. So we go even further back.
So taking this from, I mean, the film, people who love the film, love the film.
Yes.
Did you consider expectations of those filmgoers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because I'm a lover of the film. So, you know, it's a great place to start, because, you know, we're not running from the film. We're embracing it. But because we're creating our own piece of theater, and Baz has been really great about encouraging that, the theater allows you this opportunity to sort of recalibrate relationships, to explore things in sort of even deeper, grittier, more authentic ways, you know, or to take flight and fancy in other ways. And so we've been allowed a lot of opportunity, and hopefully the things that I feel really proud of in terms of when fans come up to me and be like, oh my God, this moment or this moment, it's that we delivered something that you might remember or a visual you might recognize from the film, but in a way that was wholly surprising, in a way they didn't expect. And so that feels really gratifying.
So Beetlejuice was a film, and Rocky obviously was a film. And is it different for you as the director when you take something that's previously known and also different medium as opposed to something that is organically out of theater? What's the difference between directing those kind of things? What are your different challenges? What are your different issues?
Well, you know, I'd say that there's so many films that people want to make into stage shows. And so the reason I gravitated to these three specific things, and they represent like 20% of the shows that, you know, that I work on, that I don't only do a movie to stage.
No, I understand. Yeah, yeah.
No, but it just, but I say that because these things to me all felt like they had something inherently really theatrical in their DNA. So Beetlejuice is a character just like Harold Zeidler in Moulin Rouge that can break the fourth wall and speak directly to the audience to kick over those footlights. And with Beetlejuice, you know, just like Baz with Moulin Rouge, they were very embracing of saying, the producers saying, okay, this thing needs to be as emotional as possible. So while the movies focused on the journey of the Maitlands, here we were allowed to focus our journey on the story of Lydia, the young teenage girl. She was the person that emotionally I gravitated to most. And so you're always sort of thinking like, how can we make this more emotional, more theatrical, make it its own thing, but also satisfy your expectations as someone who similarly loves the underlying property?
There's so much music. It's really, really fun. I was sharing with you that I thought, I had my theater goer hat, and then I had my interviewer hat, and then I had my formerly music business hat, when I thought, the licensing.
Right.
Oh my gosh, the licensing of all these songs. Was it hard to get all these songs? I mean, it's so many.
Yeah, there's like, I think like, you know, something like 80 songs that are in the show. You know, it was the experience of that was really of figuring out how songs integrate into the show was really exciting because we treated it really like a new musical, not a jukebox musical. So we, John Logan, the book writer, Justin Levine, the music supervisor, and I broke story. I hauled my girlfriend's keyboard across Times Square to a hotel room, and Justin started plunking out different songs. And we really just dreamed big. We, you know, what is the perfect song for this moment? And in certain cases, we were like, oh, we really want to have Roxanne here, but wouldn't it be service our story better if this character sang it instead of this character? And sort of just worked out from kind of a, like a blue sky wish list. And then reality hits of like, what can you get the rights to? And there were certain things like Nirvana, where Smells Like Teen Spirit's a big moment in the movie, but they're making a Nirvana musical apparently, so you can't get that. You can't get Queen music. Mm-hmm. And so you make other choices. And I think in the end, 10 times out of 10, you end up making smarter choices about like, oh, but wouldn't this be even cooler? And so we're really thrilled with what we end up getting the rights to.
My guest is Alex Timber. He's the director of the new Broadway show, Moulin Rouge. Something else that's really different is that Karen Olivo, who plays Satine, is very different from the Nicole Kidman Satine. People who are theater lovers will recognize her.
She's amazing.
Won a Tony as playing Anita in West Side Story in the revival. And her Satine is a little more bold, a little more self-possessed. Walk me through that casting process and the decision to sort of shift who Satine is.
Sure. Well, so, you know, one of the things that in theater you need with your protagonist is people, characters who are making positive, active choices. And I think that one of the things that was tricky, I mean, I love the film and I love Nicole Kidman's performance. I mean, it's incredible. But what I think in the theatrical adaptation, we kept thinking you need a character who can't, who has to be pushing story as much as possible and taking agency as much as possible. And so some of the kind of qualities of like, I'm locked in a tower and I dream someday of flying away, or I dream of being like, you know, purely of being a great actress. Those sometimes feel like there's a kind of, these sort of rub ups kind of strange of saying like, here's a real club with authentic, historical rules that you really brush up more against, you know, in the reality of depicting this world. So our Satines kind of needed to, I think, have, as you said, like more of a more, even more strength, even more, ability to push action, play complexity. And so I had slightly different needs than what the film did. And so we went on this very long casting search. We saw many, many people, many incredible actors. And Karen is just someone I've like really admired for years and years and years. And she has this real boldness. She has a real intellectual curiosity. She's one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And she's a true triple threat. I mean, she's like, she is an incredible dancer, as anyone who saw her play Anita knows, mm-hmm. or saw her in The Heights. Incredible singer, incredible actor. And so as soon as we saw her, we like desperately wanted for her to be our Satine. And we went through the workshop phase with her, the Boston tryout phase with her, and felt very lucky that she was wanted to continue on.
Aaron Tveit, I didn't recognize him from Next to Normal.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's a whole different thing going on with him, and they have such great chemistry.
Yeah.
Did you do chemistry tests or in the sort of traditional way, or did you just kind of figure out these are the people we want and we're going to make this work?
Well, we did do some chemistry tests. The thing in the end with Aaron and Karen is we ended up doing a workshop with them and just falling in love with them, falling in love with each other, and that's kind of the greatest role. And they're such pals and great scene partners, that it's really also been just beautiful also to watch their relationship evolve. And I would say that what's also been amazing about both those actors as they've been digging into the character and making them even more their own is that they've really impacted how John Logan looks at the script and what the choices that Justin's making with the music and Sonia Taya, who's our incredible choreographer, is making with the choreography. And it's they've really had a profound impact on the development of these characters in the show. And that's a really gratifying when actors want to dig in that way.
That's cool that they brought another energy in that made you have to sort of rethink things in a good way.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Well, we have a little bit of music we can play.
Oh, great.
Just a little bit of music we can play. One of the few originals from this show. This is Come What May. Let's take a quick listen.
There's no mountain too high, no river too wide. Sing out this song and I'll be there by your side. Storm clouds may gather and stars may collide, but I love you till the end.
A video for this with a fog machine, the whole thing. I'm curious, this is just my impression when I was watching it, and I don't know if this is in the direction or not.
Sure.
I found that Christian's character and Aaron's voice is so strong.
Beautiful.
And it's very beautiful in the first act, and then it is giant in the second act.
He goes
there.
He blows. Yeah, yeah.
I said to my friend, like, what? You know? Yeah. Was that intentional to have the second act of his voice just be blast in a way that in the first act it's almost sweeter and more romantic?
Well, he is an innocent coming into this world. You know, Satine represents experience and Christian is innocence. And so he like, as he, you know, sort of his plans get derailed several mm-hmm. times in the course of the story. And as his mind unravels a little in the second act, Aaron really makes the choice to go to a really deep and sometimes dark place. And it's just thrilling how that affects his performance vocally and physically. And it's one of those moments when he sings Roxanne every night that I just like in the eyes, I'm like, oh my God, I feel so lucky to be a part of this show.
My guest is Alex Timbers. He's directing. He did direct the new Moulin Rouge, which opens July 25th. Before I let you go, you know, after we've talked about the confetti cannons mm-hmm. and the fishnets and the sword eaters and all the kind of all the splashy, wonderful, extravagant, opulent stuff. When you wipe that all away, what is Moulin Rouge about?
And Moulin Rouge is a love story. Moulin Rouge is about. It's an impossible love story. It's about daring greatly in the face of everything stacked against you. It's about hope in the face of tragedy. It's really primal, elemental, and beautiful. And it's got lots of spectacle, but it's hard. It's something very simple and sweet. And I also these bohemian ideals that Baz talks about, truth, beauty, freedom, love. I think, you know, at this moment in America, I think we need those things more than ever. And I think Moulin Rouge is hopefully a celebration of all those ideals.
The show is locked. You locked it yesterday?
Locked it yesterday, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It's so exciting.
My guest has been Alex Timbers. The name of the show is Moulin Rouge, and he directed it. Alex, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, Christina Newman Scott, president of BRIC, will talk about BRIC Brooklyn. Oh, the original.
Ooh.
Mama lie.